This afternoon, I'd like to share some reflections about the theme that Gil talked about last night, the adhidhana, the four and a half or five adhidhanas. There are four, but you know, we're making two of one of them, chaga. And to speak about the first one, wisdom. So it's sometimes hard to translate words from Pali to English and really keep their meaning and not veer off to meanings that are not intended. And as we know, words are really powerful. And as we practice dropping in different words with different lexical connotations can veer us off into different directions. So with adhidhana, as Gil was saying, it's made up of two words in Pali, adi meaning foundational or beginning, plus tha, which means standing. So foundational standing. I kind of like that, foundational standing. So it's often translated as resolve, also translated as decision, resolution, self-determination, will, or resolute determination. So I decided to look up resolve, which is a common translation in the dictionary, and to see what the synonyms are, more synonyms: decision, resolution, commitment, steadfastness, earnestness. And the one that really spoke to me was commitment. It's just a beautiful sense that when you commit to something, you commit to, say, wisdom. There is a heart connection. There's more heart to it. And it also, for me, better keeps the root, the connection to the Pali foundational standing. It's kind of foundation when you make a commitment to something or someone. It's kind of you stand on that foundation. So I will continue to probably use the word resolve and commitment and all of that through this talk, but I think the main point I'm trying to make is that the point of taking on a commitment, say for wisdom, or making a resolve, is not to become a source for more suffering for ourselves in our practice, because by taking on a resolve for wisdom, we can create this should, and you know, every decision now should be wise one, and we're going to beat ourselves over our heads, and it can cause more and more and more suffering. So let's be wise about our adhidhanas, about how we actually invoke and how we invite these commitments, these resolutions into our practice, which are beautiful and really, really powerful. Really, really powerful. Also, I know that for me, it's helpful to get a physical, embodied sense of the words, because words can also be heady, and that's not useful in this practice, as you figured by now already. And one embodied description of adhidhana that I found is in the late canonical Buddha Vamsa, where the Bodhisattva Sumedha declares, "And as a mountain, a rock, stable and firmly based, and as a mountain, a rock, stable and firmly based, does not tremble in rough winds, but remains in precisely in its own place, so you too must be constantly stable in adhidhana. Going on to the perfection of adhidhana, you will attain self-awakening." So when I read that, I kind of got this sense of, you know, a mountain, a rock, firmly stable, stability, not trembling in rough winds, remaining precisely in its own place, there's a sense of stability and firmness. There's a sense of integrity that I can feel into physically. And I'm going to invite you, actually, as I talk about it, feel into what that feels like. If you're sitting like a mountain, a rock with stability, with integrity, not moving with winds. Ah, that's a sense of adhitana, this commitment, this resolve, this resolution, just kind of steadfast. You're not moved. The winds come and go, but there's this steadfastness. Yeah, wisdom. I'm committed to developing wisdom. It will take years, but I'm committed to it. I'm stable. Just because a day or two or a week or two or a month or two are difficult, I'm going to continue my resolve, my adhitana, commitment, stability. So, of course, it's important to commit correctly to the right thing, not inappropriate, not setting intention inappropriately. And I remembered actually something that happened to me years and years ago, last week, which I hadn't thought about for a couple of decades. So I'll share that with you because it's a good example, at least for me, of setting an intention and then kind of realizing maybe it has to be changed. Anyway, so freshman year in college, I started my freshman year and years ago. And I remember I was quite resolute. I was committed to maintaining a perfect GPA for as long as I could. That was my resolution. Which, looking back at it, and then in my first semester, I took a course in philosophy, and the first week, wide-eyed and bushy-tail, I went to this philosophy class, and in the first class, this professor says, "I don't give A's," and he said he handed out, and throughout this course, we're supposed to write these philosophical treatises about various questions, various things that he was going to give us. And he gave us an example of one that he had written. He handed it out, and he said, "I gave myself an A-minus. Because I think there's some, you know, my argument is not good enough, blah, blah, blah." And I thought, oh my goodness, okay. I left that class feeling kind of despondent. Like, come on, this is my first semester. So what to do? Should I drop the course? Should I drop the course so that I can maintain that perfect GPA, which I haven't even gotten started on yet? So it was a few days of, as my young self, not quite wise self, kind of thinking, okay, what to do? Hang in there. And I finally decided, no, keeping a perfect GPA at the cost of dropping a course I want to take is not worth it. That's not what my intention is. I decided to stick it in there. Just, I'm going to stay there, and if I don't get an A, that's fine. But maybe I will be that one person who will get an A. So, and I worked so hard in that class, so hard. And it was wonderful. I learned so much. I don't know how many hours a week I spend on these treatises. I still have them. I'm a minimalist. I haven't saved too much in my life, but I've saved those papers I wrote in my freshman philosophy class because I poured my heart and soul into them. And I did get an A. but it's for me, I remember that with resolve because I had an intention, but the intention had to be to learn, to commit myself to learning, not to maintain a perfect GPA. Who cares about that, really? So may we set our intentions, our resolves, in the right way. So speaking of the intentions, of the of the adhitanas, of the commitments, rather. I should use commitments, not intention, because that's a little different, just for consistency. So the four of them, they're laid out in Majjhima Nikaya 140. And this is how practice is advised for the four. One should not neglect wisdom. One should preserve the truth. One should cultivate relinquishment / generosity, chaga. One should train for peace, upasama. So it's interesting how each of these four have a particular action verb associated with them. Wisdom not to neglect, truth to preserve, relinquishment, generosity to cultivate, peace to train for. And what really hit me when I saw this list, especially regarding wisdom, is that one should not neglect it. So it's already there, right? You don't neglect something that's already there. It's already here, right? Isn't that interesting? So there's a sense of trust that wisdom is already here. Don't neglect it, because it is accessible if you don't forget about it, if you don't neglect it. Whereas the other one, preserve it or cultivate it, cultivate relinquishment or generosity, right? So I think that's a very interesting point, because sometimes with wisdom we think, oh, wisdom, it sounds so high and mighty, or may I be wise someday. But it's already right here. It's already right here. We all have it. We all have it. Let's just not ignore it and forget about it. Not neglect it. So I like to talk about different aspects or different definitions of wisdom now. And perhaps together find that there are different aspects of the same thing. They're all related to each other, even though the recipes may sound a little different. So I like to start with the definition of a wise person in Anguttara Nikaya 2, page 179. And it's a beautiful description, not of wisdom, but of a wise person. Practitioners, a wise person, one of great wisdom, does not intend harm to self, intend harm to others, or intend harm to both self and others. Thinking in this way, such one intends benefit for self, benefit for others, benefit for both, benefit for the world. Thus is one wise and of great wisdom. That's a pretty wonderful, low-key, accessible definition of wisdom, or a wise person rather, right? And a person of great wisdom even, not intending harm to oneself, intending harm to others, intending harm to both self and others. And then to be of benefit to self, benefit of others, and benefit to both self and others, to the whole world. So given that this is a path of awakening, of suffering and the end of suffering, this kind of makes sense intuitively, right? Not causing harm to ourselves and to others and both, and also being of benefit. It's along the lines of the end of suffering, not suffering. And it's also very practical, which is one aspect of it I really appreciate. So let's hold this definition and move on to some other ones and come back to this. So Another definition of wisdom, actually on retreat, I was thinking about this on retreat, about this being your first day of practice, and this morning we gave some invitation suggestions to not to be good at it, as Gil was saying, or as I suggested, practicing like a sick person, really being gentle with yourself. And one aspect of wisdom is knowing, in a way, what tool to use, when. You know, you all have a bag of tools. Some tool bags might be larger, some smaller, but you have a bag of tools, and to know what to use when. So last week, actually 2 weeks ago, I was teaching with Sayadaw Ujjagara, who's been a monastic, a monk in the Theravada tradition for more than 35 years, and he's French Canadian, and we were teaching a 7-day retreat. And one thing that's lovely about teaching with him is that he has a gift for visual metaphor. And one visual metaphor he came with, and I want to share today because I think it's relevant to practice on retreat, is what I call the simile of the golf club. You know, the Buddha had a lot of similes, but there was no golf when the Buddha lived. So the simile of the golf club is using the right golf club. And I don't know much about golf, by the way, so you'll soon find out. But using the right club for the right situation. Apparently, there's a club called wood, there's putter, there's sand wedge, there's iron, and each are used for a different situation. A wood is used when you want to hit the ball really, really far. Sand wedge, I think even I can figure out what that's for. When you're in the sand, I guess, you want to get the ball out. And putter is, you know, very fine movements, short movements. He was talking about this. I could just, in my mind, I was thinking, you know, there could be a sutta. If there was golf during Buddha's time, I could imagine the Buddha, just as a man would use a wood for long and a putter for short distance and a sandwich in the sand, so too, practitioner, use the correct tool, correct practice, the appropriate practice for the appropriate state of mind. And it's the appropriate practice for the appropriate state of mind. And the appropriate posture for the appropriate state of mind. So, for example, if you're feeling sleepy, maybe it's a good idea to use the appropriate posture of gently opening your eyes or doing standing meditation. If there's a lot of difficulty, if there's a lot of anger, a lot of sadness, a lot of self-pity, difficult emotions are coming up, maybe the right tool to use at that point is self-compassion, to really have self-compassion because you're hurting so much at that point, to bring in metta at that point. If you're sitting and the awareness is bright, the mind is still, maybe it is wise to continue to sit longer, etc., etc. So really having wisdom, developing your own trust in your own wisdom about what the right posture, what the right practice is in a given moment. Is it appropriate to always switch practices? Well, actually, no. Sometimes it's good to stick to one practice. Because sometimes you can find your mind shopping through a list of practices. Okay, 5 minutes on the breath. Okay, that's not working. All right, how about mindfulness of the body? Too much pain. No, forget that. Sounds. Okay, I'm going to do sounds for a few minutes. No, too many noises. No, I'm getting cranky. Too many noises in the hall. Okay, maybe I'll switch to metta now. So that's not advised. Not a good idea to kind of switch through them. But there are also times that you sit with something and you realize there's a lot of disturbance in the mind and something else might be working better. Or actually, sometimes it's actually better to stick to, say, if the mind is going every which way, and say you're doing mindfulness of the breath, and say counting the breath, staying with it, patience, so that just like a puppy that keeps running away and running away, finally the puppy rests because you're gently calming it, instead of taking it to the park and then taking it somewhere else, but just gently calming it. So I'd like to take a little foray into actually how psychologists have studied wisdom, and to bring that in, because I think it's quite relevant. And part of what I'm going to be talking about is inspired by an article in the New York Times that was entitled "The Science of Older and Wiser," which appeared on March 12th, 2014. So what was interesting and surprising to me reading this article is that there is a whole scientific field of studying wisdom. Who would have thought? So what is it? What is it exactly? We kind of know it when we see it, right? But how to define it? So it turns out a geriatric neuropsychologist in Orinda, California, whose name is Vivian Clayton, she developed a definition of wisdom in the 1970s when she was a graduate student. And she's been working on the subject ever since. So apparently, after scouring many ancient texts for evocations of wisdom, she found that most people described as wise are decision makers in the various texts. So what she did in her study, which again, you'll see the relevance, what she did in her foundational study, she asked a group of law students and law professors and retired judges to name the characteristics of a wise person. So it makes sense, you know, if in the Asian text it was a decision maker, so she went to people who make a lot of decisions, and decisions that have effects on other people's lives. So based on the analysis of the answers of the law students, law professors, and judges, she came up with three components of wisdom: cognition, reflection, and compassion. So the first component is cognition, which is the quantity of experiences and the nuanced quality of accumulated experiences to draw from. So cognition. So actually I'll go through all three and then I talk about the relevance. The second one is reflection, that one must take time to gain insights and perspectives from one's cognitive knowledge to be wise, and that is the reflective dimension. So it's not just enough to have a quantity of experience and nuanced quality, but actually to take the time to gain insight and perspective from those nuanced experiences. And the third one, the third aspect, is compassion. That then one can use those insights to understand and help others. So it's about helping others. It's about being of benefit. Does that sound familiar? To be of benefit? You remember the definition of the wise person? From Anguttara Nikaya? So to also bring this home in our practice, as we sit on the cushion And we are gaining all three of these, actually. So this is why this is a wisdom practice. There is the cognition aspect, which is the quantity of experience, nuanced quality of accumulated experience. We're observing in a very nuanced way our experience of the world, the way this mind is interacting, the way this mind is feeling, sensing, getting caught. We're collecting data. We're paying attention moment by moment by moment, paying attention. It's not always easy, but we're paying nuanced attention that we wouldn't otherwise when we're in the world, when we're busy, when we're watching television, driving, this and that. But here we're paying nuanced attention to these experiences. And then there is the reflection, which allows for insights and perspectives to arise from that knowledge, because we sit with these experiences, these nuanced experiences, with a perspective of sitting with them with a perspective of allowing them to arise and pass away and seeing the different characteristics of them, which I'll talk about more. And then naturally, compassion arises. Compassion in this practice will arise naturally from the insights. When you see the suffering, when you see the suffering in yourself, your heart will be cracked open. It can't be otherwise. There is a dimension of compassion that naturally arises for oneself and for the world. So coming back to this article, the way it is laying out the foundations of the components of wisdom. So one thing to keep in mind is, you know, decisions, we make decisions all the time. We make decisions all the time. It's not just reserved for judges. You made a decision to come here on this retreat. You made hundreds of decisions today. When to walk, where to walk, what to eat, when, how much to eat, what to put on, just thousands of decisions. So wisdom is not so much a paragon, but it's a practical everyday how-to that we can apply to our everyday lives. It's quite practical. It's in every decision. It's in the fabric of our lives. So practical wisdom. So I'd like to share something else that Vivian Clayton, this neuropsychologist, did. So to study practical wisdom, then she developed a scale consisting of 39 questions, which was aimed at measuring three dimensions, these three dimensions of wisdom that we talked about. So people would respond to statements on this wisdom scale. So there would be statements like, a problem has little attraction for me if I don't think it has a solution, or I can be comfortable with all kinds of people, or I'm easily irritated by people who argue with me. So the people who took these measures at the questionnaire were not told that they were being measured for wisdom. And respondents answered questions about hypothetical challenges, crises, and it was interesting that those who showed evidence of higher levels of wisdom were also more likely to have better coping skills. And in general, this other researcher, Professor Ardelt, found that people in higher level of wisdom, and I'll talk more about that, they tended to be more active than passive about dealing with hardship. And again, I'll bookmark this and I'll talk more about this. So one thing that's interesting, for example, an impediment to wisdom would be thinking something like, I can't stand who I am now, because I'm not who I used to be. And this, for example, given that this study was done in gerontology, people who are much older, when there is an acceptance of how things are, an acceptance of how, say, one ages, the physical abilities change, how one's memories change, memory changes, etc., etc. That acceptance, which is not a resigned acceptance, but an embracing acceptance, it's a correlate of this wisdom, which also comes with equanimity. So this term of acceptance can actually be also a little complicated and difficult to work with. So let me talk about it a little more. So the idea of acceptance perhaps is better framed with non-conflict, and I know Gil likes this, non-conflict or non-resistance. So the idea is not so much that you are completely accepting and giving into the premise of how things are, but it's accepting how you feel with respect to something that's happening. So it's a non-resistance. It's a non-resistance. It's allowing whatever is happening in the moment to be without resisting the reality of it as it's showing up in the moment. Not necessarily validating or approving whatever belief is behind it, but it's allowing whatever the truth of this moment is without resisting it. Do you see the difference? If no, just say no, and I'll repeat it because it's a little nuanced. Yeah, no, okay, good. I'm seeing some no's. All right, let me clarify. So the idea is basically, say, I have back pain right now as I'm sitting here. You know, if my back hurts And if I resist it, and I shouldn't be this way. Oh, this is so distracting. I'm giving it Dharma talk. Oh, this is terrible. Is it ever going to go away? Am I going to be able to concentrate on what I'm going to say? Oh, right? There's a resistance, right? You hear the resistance. So now the acceptance or the non-resistance will be, okay, yep. Sensation, okay. Yeah, that's uncomfortable, but that's what's happening right now in this body. Okay? Yep. Ah, and just as I say that, even though I'm kind of making an example of show out of it, my back actually relaxes. My back relaxes when I allow it to be just as it is. Just as it is. Yeah. Yeah, it's not very comfortable. It's kind of tight. And it's okay. It's actually okay. But if I tighten, it's like, oh, darn it. Oh, not during my Dharma talk. Oh, it's actually interesting. It's just hard. Even as I say it, this is so powerful. It's starting to like tighten up just as I talk about it. Okay. So you see how that works now? Is that clear? So that's the idea of not resisting whatever is arising in the moment. And that is an aspect of wisdom, because you're not resisting reality that's showing up right now. Not to condone, I'm not condoning that, yeah, back pains are good, and there are a lot of things in the world that we need to resist. There's a lot of social injustice in the world that we need to resist and work towards undoing. But this aspect of acceptance is something different. is something different. It's allowing what is happening right now in the heart and mind, not resisting it, so that actually what becomes interesting is that when we have this aspect, this perspective of non-resistance, there is more allowing, there's more energy, there's more ease available to then act wisely towards undoing whatever we need to do in the world. So it seems counterintuitive, but well, maybe it's not counterintuitive because it makes sense. Because if we're stuck in that resistance, then there is no available energy, really, because we're so stuck in that resistance. It just can't get out of it, can't even can act. And to say, when you have non-resistance, non-conflict, or acceptance, choose your favorite phrase, with respect to the reality of the moment, then, as I said, it really becomes a stepping stone towards wise action, instead of being stuck in this should not be happening to me right now. So think about it. Think about how on retreat, this happens so often, we get caught. We get caught in, oh, I'm sleepy, I've come here to practice, this shouldn't be happening right now. Or, oh, I'm sitting and trying to develop a calm, a unified mind, and my mind is a monkey mind right now. This should not be happening right now. And that resistance, instead of, oh, okay, well, monkey mind, distracted Buddha, this is what it feels like right now, okay, all right. There is ease in that, and then you can bring the awareness, the attention back and back again. But in that resistance, there's so much energy that can be wasted in that. And one other thing to say, by the way, about acceptance or non-conflict, non-resistance, is that you can't always will it. You can't will yourself to accept. And sometimes it happens that, people try, okay, I'm trying to accept that I'm in pain. And it's so hard because then it becomes resistance of accept. It just kind of gets all twisted. So don't try too hard. Don't will it. So the thing I suggest is, if non-conflict, if acceptance is accessible, then okay. And if it's not, then make peace with not being able to make peace with whatever it is right now. Okay, my back is hurting and I don't like it and I can't get around it. Okay, all right, then I'm going to accept that. Instead of, oh, I'm a terrible yogi, I'm a terrible Dharma teacher, I'm not accepting that I... And sometimes actually, the twist then would be accepting the resistance. Yeah, right now the mind is just not ready to accept or be okay with it. So I'm going to accept not being... okay, I'm going to be okay with not being okay. And there is ease in that. Does that make sense? So start where you are. Start where you are. Can you be okay with not being okay? Can you be okay with not being okay but not being okay? You know, however many levels you need to go to find some okayness. Non-resistance, non-conflict. That's a place where wisdom grows, because it becomes a stepping stone. So I like to say a few things also. sometimes, in terms of wisdom, it's helpful to also see it in others. Because in terms of embodiment, when I was talking about it earlier, you know, the rock, for example, with Aditana, with wisdom, it's wonderful when you have embodiments of wisdom, both in yourself, at times when you have acted with wisdom, to really tap into that and see what that feels like, what that felt like. And also, people in your life that you know. Think of wise people that you know, either in your life or archetypal figures of wisdom. And kind of think about yourself, think about them. What are the features? What is it about them that makes them wise to you? Does the person have ease about them? Do they have a sense of compassion? Actually, let's just do that together for a moment. If you would just close your eyes and bring to mind one person or however many people you want. Just feel into, like physically feel into this being, this person. What makes them wise? In your eyes. Does this person have humility? Is it kindness? Is it judgment? Is it compassion? Is it experience, reflectivity? Just whatever it might be. It's good to have a felt sense of what that's like as an inspiration. And I invite you to open your eyes and come back to the room. So now that you have, perhaps you've tapped into some aspects, some features of what it feels like to be with a wise person or a wise person that you know in your life. Be interesting for a moment to talk about what wisdom isn't. So first of all, it is not necessarily or intrinsically a product of old age, because we know, well, some of us may know some very young people, even sometimes kids, who seem wise beyond their age. However, there's something about reaching an advanced age that increases the odds of acquiring the kinds of life experiences and emotional maturity that cultivate wisdom. And actually, that is an aspect that has been attracting the attention of the gerontological psychologists. Have you noticed that some people, not everyone, all people, but as people get older, they tend to get more chilled? Some people, not everyone. And I've seen that also. Yeah, it's interesting. I saw that in my grandmother, actually. The older she became, the gentler and more loving she became. When she was younger, she was, you know, she was loving, but she was strict, more strict about rules. But then when she got older, it was just all love, like all those rules, yeah, whatever. But there's something about wisdom, it was all love for her when she got older and older. It was really sweet. Another aspect of lack of wisdom, rather, is if you think you're wise, you're probably not. So, as Gandhi says, and by the way, apparently a few years ago, in a survey among college students, they were asked to name wise people. Gandhi topped the leaderboard on that survey. But anyways, he says, it is unwise to be too sure of one's own wisdom. And also from Dhammapada, here's a beautiful line, poem, or translation from the Dhammapada in the section entitled The Fool. It says, a fool conscious of her foolishness is to that extent wise, but a fool who considers himself wise is the one to be called a fool. I like that. In fact, the general thread that runs through the modern wisdom research is that wise people tend to be humble and other-centered as opposed to self-centered. That makes sense, doesn't it? Did you kind of see that in the wise person that you conjured up? Maybe. But I certainly see that in the wise people I think of. Some other qualities associated with wisdom for your consideration. And again, this tends to recur in the academic literature on wisdom research. One is a clear-eyed view of human nature and the human predicament. Let me try that again. A clear-eyed view of human nature and the human predicament. That's better. The Persian accent jumps out when I least expect it. Predicament. Human predicament. Emotional resiliency and the ability to cope in the face of adversity. An openness to other possibilities. Openness, an aspect of wisdom. Openness. Forgiveness as an aspect of wisdom. Not holding on. Humility, as I already mentioned before, as an aspect of wisdom. And a knack for learning from lifetime experiences. Learning from experiences. And that's not just lifetime experiences, but also, I think, sitting on the cushion, it's all about experiencing the moment. Just these nuances of experience, seeing the mind clearly, learning from that. One thing that's actually particularly interesting to me is there is a yin and yang that makes the idea of wisdom, perhaps, in some ways, in the academic literature, hard to pin down. So, wisdom is founded upon knowledge, but part of the physics of wisdom is shaped by uncertainty. So, even though action is important, but so is judicious inaction. And even though emotion is central to wisdom, yet lack of attachment is essential. So there is a yin and yang to wisdom. It's not so set. It is shaped by uncertainty of the moment as it arises, even though it is founded upon experience and a lot of knowledge. And with that openness of meeting the moment new and fresh and not having preconceived notions of what should be and what should be done and perceptions being layered on top. And just to say a little bit about the first line, the clear-eyed view of human nature and the human predicament, that really ties into seeing things as they are. The characteristics, impermanence, our lives are impermanent, everything is impermanent. Every moment is a birth and a death. The last moment is gone. There's an elemental impermanence in our life, in our experience, nothing to hold on to. So that allows for embracing change. Not with resignation, but that change is inevitable. Not holding on to what we cannot hold on to. And there is wisdom to that. There is wisdom in embracing change and impermanence completely. Anicca, impermanence. And then dukkha, suffering or stress. That it is part of life. That there is stress, things don't go right. That's not a grim resignation. Both good and not so good things happen. There are the eight worldly winds of pain and sorrow, gain and loss, praise and blame, success and failure. And then the truth of anatta, not self, that this being, this self, this body, this mind, is ungovernable. It's a process. We are nature. This body gets old, it gets sick, it changes. Accepting all that. And again, it's not a resignation, but clearly seeing. And that's another aspect of wisdom. That's another aspect of wisdom. Seeing things as they are. So, and I want to share one very last aspect of wisdom. Perhaps. And that I just learned recently. Apparently it's known as the Rule 62 of Spiritual Toolkit. And it goes like this. Don't take yourself so damn seriously. I think that is an aspect of wisdom also. Lightness, humor. So I've offered a lot of different dimensions and aspects of wisdom for your consideration tonight. Please take what works for you, what allows wisdom to arise, and feel free to discard the rest. Let's just sit together for a moment. May we all practice with commitment, adhitana, of not neglecting wisdom. Thank you for your kind attention.